Okay, so today we're going to be moving on to genre analysis, but before we go on to genre analysis, just let me say that a lot of what I'm going to be telling you about genre analysis, you probably already know, because you've been taking Steve's course. Most of you are taking Steve Bremner's course, Professional and Corporate Discourse, correct? You're not? No? But most of you are. So Steve has gone into quite a lot of detail about genre analysis, and I think that he's going to be using genre analysis quite a lot in his course. And so for our treatment of genre analysis, I'm just going to review some of the major ideas and perhaps take a slightly different strategy than Steve did in looking at genres. But before we go into genre analysis, I just want to review a little bit what we did last week. Last week we talked about the ethnography of speaking, and we talked about the speaking model as a kind of way to help us to analyze a kind of social situation. And the speaking model is set out right here. So it's divided up into different aspects of the communicative event. So as a review, why don't we try to use the speaking model to analyze our classroom right now, okay? So, Joanne, the first letter in the speaking model is S, yeah? What does S stand for? Setting and scene, yeah, setting and scene. So what is the setting and scene of our classroom? Okay, P4909. Yeah, anything else? CTU, anything else? Three thirty to 6:30. So the setting and scene has to include both the place and the time. But is there anything else that we might want to include in setting and scene other than just the place and the time? Henry, you have any ideas? Mm-hmm. So something about the mood of the situation. Now, of course, we do have a special component that deals just with the mood of the situation, and that's key. But in the scene, there are certain aspects of the situation that are created not just by the physical space and the time, but also by the people. So one important aspect of this is what we would call use of space, yeah? So, Henry, is there anything unique about the use of space in a classroom like this? How do we use our space? Is there anything unique about the way the people are arranged? Okay, so all the seats are facing me. Yeah, all the seats are in rows like this. Now, not all classrooms are like this, but our classroom happens to be like this. And the fact that our seats are in rows rather than in circles, or we're not sitting on the floor, right, or we're not standing up, as you say, creates a certain kind of formality in our classroom, yeah, a certain kind of mood in our classroom. Another aspect of the use of space is my use of space, right? So I'm standing up here facing you while you're sitting there watching me. So that's setting and scene, setting and scene. What about the participants? Who are, Terry, who are our participants here? You and me and her, right? And everyone here. So we're the participants. It's pretty easy. Teacher and students are the participants. Particular kinds of participants, are there any engineering students in this class? No. Are there any Chinese history students in this class? No. So all of the students in this class are studying BAEP, or at least most of them are studying BAEP. So that's an important aspect of the participants in this class. Now, along with participants, we always also want to think about participant roles. So there are different participants here, and different participants have different rights and obligations, okay? I have the right to talk whenever I want, but you don't have the right to talk whenever you want. I have the obligation to come here and teach this class. You have the obligation to come here and listen to me teach this class. I have a certain amount of power that you don't have, but you also have a certain amount of power too over me. For example, at the end of this course, you might fill in an evaluation of my teaching, something like that. So if you don't like me, you can give me all zero, things like that. Don't do that, but you can if you want. So along with just the physical bodies of the participants, participants also has something to do with what participants do, right? What are the various rights and responsibilities and obligations of the different kinds of participants? What about ends? Janice, what does ends mean? The purpose. Right. So what's the purpose? Well, my purpose is lecturing. Is your purpose lecturing?
Learning.
Oh, your purpose is learning. Okay, so the fact is we actually have different purposes. Right? Now, I believe you, Janice, when you say that your purpose is learning, and I commend you for that. I think that's wonderful. And I'm sure most of us have that purpose, but there are other purposes for coming to this class as well, right? Other than simply learning. Kitty.
Yes.
Why are you here? Okay, so one day you were just sitting around at home and you thought, gee, I really want to know about discourse and pragmatics. I really like to learn about that. And so you enrolled for this course. Is that the way it happened? Not exactly. Why did you enroll for discourse and pragmatics this semester? Why did you choose it?
It is a course.
Exactly. The fact is you didn't choose it. Right? The fact is you have to be here. Right? So in a way, the main purpose for most of you being here is because you have to be here, because you want to get a degree. So your purpose is to complete your core course so you can get a BA, EP degree. So learning is one purpose, but there are other purposes underneath the purpose of learning, and different people may have different purposes, may have other purposes that we haven't mentioned. And for the same way, for me, of course, my main purpose here is to teach you about discourse and pragmatics, for which I have an abiding love. But other than that, my purpose is to get my salary, because if I don't come here and teach you, they won't pay me any money, right? And I won't do it for free, I'm sorry, okay? And so one thing that's really important when we're looking at purpose, when we're looking at ends, is to realize that ends are always multiple. Right? That purposes are always multiple, and purposes are also always various. That is, different participants will have different purposes. So you can see there's a relationship between purposes and participants. Yeah? So different participants will have different purposes, and the purposes also impact on the participant roles, right? Since my purpose is teaching and your purpose is learning, then I'm going to be doing different things in this particular setting than you're going to be doing in this setting. So we come to A. A. What's A? Meg, what's A? Act sequence. So what is the act sequence of this course? Okay, so actually the act sequence is a little bit different for me than for you, right? I do different things than you do. But the class has a kind of predictable order, yeah? So first thing is you all come to the room and I come to the room, right? And then what's the first thing I do? I take attendance, okay? And then what's the second thing I do? Okay, good. So one thing you can see, since you've been to the class for 3 weeks already, is that there is a predictable act sequence, right? That every week I'll always revise a little bit what we talked about last week before going into the new topic, right? Then I'll introduce the new topic, then I'll give some examples about the new topic, then I'll give you some kind of exercise or some kind of discussion or some kind of activity about the new topic, and then hopefully if we have time I can give you some kind of conclusion about the new topic. So we can see that the sequence of acts, right, is quite different. And along with that, we can see that within each of these acts, the participants act quite differently, don't they? Right? So, for example, when I'm lecturing, when I'm into the explanation of the new topic, mostly it's just me talking and you're listening. But then if I ask you to do some kind of activity, then you talk among yourselves with your classmates, and then you feedback your information to me. And so you're doing very, very different things. So you can see that the act sequence is also related to participants, because participants have different roles in different act sequences. Act sequence is also related to setting as well, in particular, use of space. Yeah? So, for example, when we're in that lecturing part, right, you're all sort of looking up at me and I'm talking. But if we're doing some kind of activity, you might move your chairs around, right? You might form small groups or circles and stuff like that. So the setting actually changes as we go through the different act sequences in this speech event. And even act sequence has some kind of relationship with the purpose as well, because the purpose of taking attendance is not the same as the purpose of giving the lecture or the purpose of you doing some kind of activity to understand some of the materials. So the purpose actually will change slightly throughout the speech event as well. Key. What is key? What is key? Emily, what is key? 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 Not this key? No? What is key? The mood. So, actually this idea of key comes from music. You know, if any of you play music, you know that when you play something in a minor key, it has a kind of a sad feeling. And when you play something in a major key, it has a brighter, happier sort of feeling. And so key has to do with the mood of the situation. What is the key? What is the key of our classroom? German, what's the mood here? What's the mood? What do you think? Happy, sad, ecstatic, bored. Happy and warm, thank you. I always try to create a happy and warm key. But actually that's not true, is it? All right? It's not true. Sometimes it's happy and warm, and sometimes it's angry and cold. Yeah? And sometimes it's formal, and sometimes it's informal. Alright? Sometimes I'm, you know, quite seriously explaining some concept of discourse analysis. Sometimes I might tell a joke, something like that. Sometimes you're quite seriously looking at your notes and making some notes on your papers, and sometimes you're happily chatting with your classmates. And so, again, the key is something that's actually not, it's not constant throughout the entire speech event. So the key has something to do with the act sequence. Right? When we're doing different things, then the key is going to change slightly. The key is also going to be related to the purpose, right? I'll create different kinds of moods for different purposes. And of course, the key is also related to the participants as well. The next one is instrumentalities. Jason. Hi. Instrumentalities. What are the instrumentalities we're using here in this classroom? Okay, yeah, so name some. Okay, got my pen. Anything else I'm using? I'm using the projector, that's good. The computer, yeah. Anything else? iPod, yeah, I'm using my iPod. This is a very expensive iPod, by the way. Just want to mention that to you. Yeah, so I'm using the iPod to record this so you can listen to it later. And I have these things here. What are these? These are name cards to take attendance. Do I use all of these things constantly throughout the lecture? Or do I just use, do I use these name cards constantly throughout the lecture? Well, actually I do, because they're arranged in the way you're seated, so it helps me to remember your names better. But in terms of taking attendance, I really only use them in one of the acts in the act sequence. Right? I use the iPod throughout, we probably use this throughout, but then there are other things. Like, for example, last week we had some special stuff, do you remember? With the dancing and so what is that instrumentality? Video. So sometimes I use video, sometimes I don't, right? It depends on whether I'm trying to give you an example or not. So again, the instrumentalities is related to the act sequence. The instrumentalities are also related to participants because I have access to this particular instrumentality. I can project anything I want on this screen. But Henry can't come up to the computer and decide to, you know, play online games or something and project them onto the screen, right? So different participants have access, to different instrumentalities in the classroom, right? Norms. This is the hardest one. So I'll pick the smartest student to answer the hardest one, yeah? How about Joe? Hi. Yeah, what do we mean by norms? Norms is kind of hard. What do we mean? Yeah, it's kind of like a rule. Expectations. Yeah? We call it norms of interaction. Yeah? So, can you give me an example? Okay, that's a norm of interaction, that you need to come here at a certain time, that you need to sit down at a certain time. Really, norms of interaction have to do with the way we communicate certain things and the way we interpret what other people communicate. So many of the norms of interaction in this classroom are quite straightforward because I'm talking in a very explicit way, and you know, you're interpreting what I'm saying in a very kind of explicit way. But there are other things that I do. So, for example, I might be here setting up the PowerPoint on the computer, and then I stand up. And when I stand up, then you sort of arrange your things and kind of look up, and you're ready for the class to begin. So you know that when I move from here to here, that means that something's going to happen, right? That I'm going to start talking, that the class is going to begin, that sort of thing. And so norms of interaction, there are a lot of norms of interaction that are quite specific to our classroom. And again, norms of interaction are related to act sequence because there are different expectations about how to interpret things in different act sequences. Norms of interaction are also very, very highly related to participants because different participants are allowed to produce different kinds of speech acts, right? I can produce acts like commands and scolding and things like this, whereas those are not so available to you. You can produce acts like comments and questions and observations and this kind of thing. And then the last one is genre. And this is really what we're going to be focusing on today for the entire 3 hours is this last one, genre. So what do we mean by genre? And what is the genre? What is the genre of this class? Chloe. What is the genre? Okay, so is the genre of this class a lecture? Is it? Is it a common feature of a lecture that the lecturer be seated like this? No. No, it isn't. Is it a common feature of a lecture that the professor asks you questions all the time? Maybe some lectures, but not all lectures. In fact, when I think of a lecture, I think of a guy, you know, standing behind a thing, a podium, right, with a microphone, talking, right, and everyone in the audience sleeping, or you know, taking notes or listening, that sort of thing. But actually, in this class, we do some of that, yeah? We do some of, you know, me talking and you listening, but then part of it is also more kind of interactive. I ask you questions, you give me answers, and then part of it is you actually talking among yourselves in kind of group discussions and then giving me some feedback. So that's really not a lecture either. So it's a bit more, sometimes it's a bit more like a tutorial, yeah? Sometimes it's a bit more like a dancing class. I think last week was a bit like a dancing class. So the fact is, it's really, really hard to decide what this one is. Yeah? Because what we do in this classroom, and I think in most classrooms in City U, is we mix different genres together. We have the genre of lecture. We might have the genre of tutorial. We might have the genre of small group discussion. We might have the genre of video watching, right, or film watching, something like this, right? So we mix different kinds of genres together. Now, not all classrooms do this, right? Some classrooms stick to one genre, just a lecture, just a tutorial. But I suspect for most of your classes here at City U, they mix the genres together. It's a kind of mixture of different genres. And the kind of genre it is really has to do a lot with the act sequence, has to do a lot with the instrumentalities, has to do a lot with the key, doesn't it? Right? Because when I'm lecturing, it has a different key than when I'm not. Has to do a lot with the participants, right? Even has to do a lot with the purpose as well. Finally, it has to do a lot with the setting, because the setting will change as the kind of genre changes. So the point I'm trying to make by drawing all of these lines, I'm sure you've desperately been trying to draw all the lines on your paper. The point I'm trying to make in drawing all of these lines is that all of these components are not separate. Yeah? They're somehow interrelated with one another. They're related in a kind of web of relationships. And the fact is, this web of relationships is going to be slightly different for every speech event that you analyze. Right? The relationship between the different components is going to be different for every speech event. And so when I said last week that in order to do this kind of thing successfully, you've got to go beyond simply description, this is part of what I meant. That when you analyze a situation, it's not enough just to fill out the form, yeah, just to fill in the blanks. Oh, setting, you know, 330, you know, City U, and all this stuff. Right? You've got to somehow look at the way the different components work together in a unique way for this particular classroom. So really the question you would ask is, what is it that's different about this classroom, about this speech event, from your other classes in City U, right? And in order to understand that, you'd want to look at the relationship between the things, understanding how the different components work together. And ideally, you would want to analyze it to try to solve some kind of problem. There's no point to analyze something just for analyzing it, you know, just to fill out the form and then you finish it. What's the point? What have you gotten? So it's quite useful to start out with some kind of question. So I might start out with a question like, well, how can I make this a more successful class? Right? And then I might look at these different components and look at the relationship between the components and analyze, and I say, okay, the students seem really bored. There's a kind of, you know, not a very good key when I'm doing this particular act sequence, participating in this genre, using this instrumentality. Perhaps if I changed the instrumentality, brought in some video, then I would change the genre a little. That would change the key, right? And it would change the way participants are interacting with one another, that sort of thing, right? So this is the kind of thing we can use this sort of analysis to do. Another last point I just want to make is the point right here, ethnography. It's called the ethnography of speaking. And ethnography is a very specific thing. Yeah? What is ethnography? Grace, what is ethnography? Something about different cultures. Looking at different cultures, something like that. English is actually quite easy. Yeah, it's almost as easy as Chinese. Yeah, in that if you don't know the meaning of the word, you can look at the parts of the word. Right? Just like a Chinese character. If you don't know the meaning of the character, you can say, oh, it has like three dots, has something to do with water, or something like that. Same with English, right? You can look at the parts of the word. And so ethnography has two parts. First part is ethno. Ethno means a people or a culture or a group of people, that sort of thing. Anyone know what graphy means? Graph. Graphy. What does graphy mean? So we have photography, cartography. Graphy means to draw. To draw a picture. So ethnography is basically drawing a picture of a group of people, right? Or giving a kind of description of a group of people. But in ethnography, we don't just give any kind of superficial description, like a short sketch. We try to give what's called a deep analysis, right? We try to give a deep description of the place. And so in order to do that, we use a particular technique called participant observation. So we go, we live with the people, we participate with them, we work with them, we eat with them, we try to understand what it's like to be a member, what it's like to have all of this stuff in your head. Yeah? Because you really can't understand it from the outside. I think we saw that last week when we were looking at that church service. Right? That we can look at it from the outside and we can fill in some of this. Yeah? But there's quite a lot happening that we don't know if we're not participating. For example, participants. For an outside observer, maybe the participants include just the people in the church. Yeah? But for the participants in the church, God, who is an invisible participant to us, is a very important participant to them. Right? So the purpose of doing this kind of deep description, this participant observation, is to understand what it feels like, yeah, to be someone actually doing this. Right? And that's one of the important aspects of the ethnography of speaking, that we're not just trying to look at the situation from the outside, but we're trying to get inside and understand the experiences of the participants, the lived experiences of the participants. And so that's what we did last week. Speaking, setting and scene, participants, ends, act sequence, key instrumentalities, norms, and finally genre. And today we're going to move on to another kind of discourse analysis which focuses just on one of these components, focuses on the genre part of these components. So what is a genre? What is a genre? You already know what a genre is. You took Steve's class. You should know. Bowie, what is a genre? Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
They also have the conventional rules.
Okay.
That's shared by the
specific community. Okay, so it's a kind of writing. It doesn't necessarily have to just be writing. It could be singing, yeah? It could be video or film or anything like that. But it's something that has some kind of purpose within a community. That's a very important point. And something that has a kind of conventionalized structure, right? That is, most of the times you see it, it's pretty much done the same way, right? So you learn how to do it. You know how to do the genre. For example, if you work in a company, you know how to write a sales letter for that company, and you always do it in a certain kind of way. But the problem with genre, the idea of genre, is that it's a little bit slippery, right? It's a little bit vague. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to actually figure out what genre something is. Let's look at some examples, okay? We have Romeo and Juliet. Romeo and Juliet. You all know Romeo and Juliet? You know them personally? Yeah. You know them? Okay. So Romeo and Juliet. What is Romeo and Juliet? What is it? It's a what? Okay, it's literature. So we can say it's we have this genre called literature, and it's part of this genre. It's literature, yeah. But there are lots of things that are literature. Maybe Harry Potter is also literature. I don't know. Yeah. So is there anything special about this? Okay. So in some way, it's a romance. But before that, you know, some kinds of literature are like little short things that rhyme and you read them. Some kinds of literature are long books that you read. What kind of literature is Romeo and Juliet? What kind of literature? Is it? It's a play. Very good. It's a drama. It's a drama. Right. So in literature, we have drama. And a drama is a play, right? It's meant to be performed. It is written down. You can go to the bookstore, buy a book called Romeo and Juliet. But the way it's written is, you know, one person says something and then you see their line. Then you see the other person's name. So it's meant to be acted. It's meant to be performed. So you can read Romeo and Juliet, but you can also watch Romeo and Juliet. In fact, Romeo and Juliet can also be a film, right? It was a very, very good film with Leonardo DiCaprio, right? He did Romeo and Juliet. And then, as Kitty said, it's a romance. So a romance is a love story, right? Romeo and Juliet are in love, right? So what about love stories? You've seen a lot of love stories. You go to the movies, you see love stories. Should a love story have a happy ending or a sad ending? Happy ending. Both happy and sad. Yeah, most love stories, though, they have a happy ending, isn't it? You know, they have some problems, but in the end, the guy and the girl, they get together, everything's okay, you see them riding off into the sunset, the nice music is playing, that sort of thing, right? How about Romeo and Juliet? Does Romeo and Juliet have a happy ending? Everybody dies. Yeah, everybody dies. At the end of the play, the whole stage is full of dead bodies, isn't it? Right? So it's not a kind of conventional kind of romance. That is, it doesn't have the features of all romances. It has also features from a different kind of drama. Do you know what that kind of drama is called? Good. A kind of drama where everyone dies is called a tragedy. Right? So Romeo and Juliet, we can say it's a romance and we can say it's a tragedy because it has features of both a romance and a tragedy. But really what it is a kind of mixture of these two genres. So we can see, first of all, when we look at genre, that we can classify things in very broad genres, like literature. So if you go to page one, for example, you're looking for Romeo and Juliet, you know, the person might say, oh, it's in the literature section, right? So you go and you find it in the literature section. But within the literature section, there are many subgenres, for example, novel, short story, poetry, and drama. So this is drama. And then within drama, there are lots of different kinds of dramas, romances, tragedies, comedies, that sort of thing. And so we can see that this one is actually kind of a mixture of two genres, right? A mixture of romance and a mixture of tragedy. What about Harry Potter? I can see Bowie really loves Harry Potter. Yeah, you're a big Harry Potter fan? Yeah? So what is Harry Potter? Okay, children's novel. Okay, that's good. Can we call it like children's literature? Something like that? Children's literature? But I think that's quite good, but do only children read Harry Potter? I read Harry Potter. Yeah, it's great. I love it. Yeah. So actually, the thing about Harry Potter is more than just children read Harry Potter, right? So maybe it's part of children's literature. Maybe it's intended for children, but actually adults like it too, right? When we were talking here about literature, we divided literature into drama, blah, 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 blah. What is Harry Potter? Is Harry Potter a drama? Is it a poem? What is it? Is it a story? A long story. So what's a long story called? You already said it, Bowie? A novel, right? So it's a novel. So you have to be careful in English. In Chinese, you have this word. This word actually means story and novel. Yeah? It means story and novel, right? In English, we divide them up, okay? So we call a story something that's short. We call a novel something that's long, right? So if it's just like 20 pages, something like that, it's a story, right? If it's 200 pages, it's a novel. So this is a novel. What kind of novel is it? Is it science fiction? Not really. Is it love story? But it has a little bit, especially the last one. It has a little bit. But it's not a love story. What is it? History? Is it history? A mystery. Is it mystery? Magic, yeah. So, I mean, there's stuff that's mysterious about it, but a mystery is actually a different kind of genre, isn't it? A mystery is the kind of genre usually involves a detective. Yeah, and you have to figure out who committed the crime. You have to solve the mystery, right? So magic, I think we would probably call it something like fantasy. Fantasy, yeah. So a kind of so again, we can see that when we're looking at genres, that actually we have several genres often kind of internested in one another. We have the large genre, like children's literature, and then a smaller genre novel, and then a smaller genre fantasy. And in fact, since there are so many Harry Potter books, we might even call Harry Potter book a genre, isn't it? Right? Because if you've read 4 or 5 Harry Potter books, then you already have a set of expectations about the conventional way that the Harry Potter book is going to go. Right? And so when you have a situation like that, it's almost become its own genre. What about this one? Yuan Liang Dai Biao Wo De Shi. Yuan Liang Dai Biao Wo De Shi. Right? You know this song? Yeah, it's a very good song for the Moon Festival as well. Isn't it? Yeah, yeah. So what is this? What is the genre of this? Okay, it's a song. It's a song, but, you know, there are a lot of songs. Okay, so it's a song. But you say it's a pop song. It's a pop song, right? Somebody said it was an old song. My generation, right? Old pop song. Right? But it's a particular kind of pop song as well, isn't it? It's what does it talk about in this song? What's the love? It's the topic of the song is love, and so it's a love song. It's a love song. What kind of love song is it? It's a Taiwanese love song, isn't it? Now, I know, you know, there are love songs in Cantonese pop music and American pop music and Japanese pop music, but the love songs in Taiwanese pop music are very special. They're very sweet. Yeah? They have this kind of real sweetness to them that distinguishes them, that makes them a particular kind of genre. In fact, I would be so specific as to say that this is a 1970s Taiwanese love song. Right? 1970s, wasn't it? Yeah, quite a long time ago. And I think that actually the Taiwanese love songs in the 1970s were a little bit different from the ones in the 1980s and the 1990s. Right? So sometimes with genres you can be very, very specific. And sometimes genres are very connected to a particular place and a particular time. Yeah. So for example, certain kinds of songs, certain kinds of performances, Cantonese opera, for example. Right? Cantonese opera is only really a genre of a particular area, a particular place, that is Hong Kong and southern China. Right? And so sometimes you can really situate genres into time and place. What about this? Yat but ao siu. Yat but ao siu. Yat but ao siu. What is that? What is that? It's a show. Okay, so it's a TV show. TV show. But you say it's a special kind of TV show called what? What's it called? A game show. What kind of game show? Because there are lots of different kinds of game shows. You know, they have those game shows where, you know, the girl is looking for a date, right, looking for some boy to date, and then three boys come and they talk about why they should date her. And then you have those other kinds of game shows where the contestants have to do very strange things, like eat a lot of pie or do some kind of strange activities. There's Japanese game shows. They're always very, very strange. Is this kind of game show like this? What do they do on this game show? Have you watched this show? It's a little bit old. Have you watched it? What do they do? Bowie, what's the procedure? Kitty? Exactly. Questions and answers. It's questions and answers, okay? They ask a question, the contestants have to answer the question. If they answer the question correctly, then they go on to the next round, right? And then they can win a lot of money, that sort of thing. So it's a special kind of game show. We have a name for it, actually. We call it a quiz show. Quiz show. Quiz show. What about a Facebook page? How many people have a Facebook page? Nobody? Of course, everybody has a Facebook. Even if you don't have a Facebook page, even if you don't raise your hand, I bet you still do have a Facebook page, but you just don't want me to go and try to be your friend on your Facebook page. Okay? So, what is a Facebook page? What genre is a Facebook page? Peggy, what genre is a Facebook page? Okay, but what's the genre? What type of thing is it? What is it? Okay, it's a web page. But is it like all other kinds of web pages? Like a community. All right? So in some ways it's like a web page, but in other ways it's like a kind of community, a kind of community thing. All right? In some ways, it's like a photo album, isn't it? All right? You put up your photos and your friends can look at your photos. Right. It also takes things from other things. For example, in some ways, it's like a whiteboard, isn't it? Because you have a little board, and then people can draw pictures on it, people can leave messages on it, things like that. It's also like a game, because you can invite your friends to play some kind of card games or something like that with you. Right? You don't know? Oh, you don't have a Facebook page. Wow, you're missing so much. It's great. In some ways, in some ways it's like email, yeah? Because you can send messages to each other, right? In some ways it's like a personal dating advertisement because you can put up really good-looking pictures of yourself and try to attract people to come and talk to you, right? So if you ask me what is the genre of a Facebook page, I would have to say that the genre of a Facebook page is a Facebook page because there's really nothing like it, isn't it? It's a brand new genre. That's why it's so successful. That's why people like it so much, yeah? Because it's like nothing else. You can do different things. For example, you know, with MSN or ICQ, you can chat with people, or with, you know, some other, like, you know, face pick or something like this, you can put up your pictures for other people to see them, but there isn't any other genre that integrates all of these different functions together, right, like a Facebook page does. And so nowadays we see this particularly that there are a lot of new genres starting, right, and a Facebook page is a good example of a new genre, right, that draws on aspects of other genres but puts them together in a very kind of unique way. And I think moshing is also a similar kind of thing to this. You know what moshing is, German? Have you ever moshed before? You want to try? You don't want to try? It's a lot of fun. Well, moshing, what you do when you're moshing is you set up this kind of fence. Right? And then a whole bunch of people, maybe hundreds of people, stand inside this area, this fence. Right? And then somebody jumps on top of the crowd of people, and they're carried around the crowd of people on their hands like this. Right? This is called moshing. Right? This is known as a mosh pit. What is moshing? What genre is it? It's really strange, isn't it? I tried to figure it out myself, and I went to the internet, and I looked it up on the internet, and one of the web pages said that it was a kind of sport. Yeah? A kind of physical exercise, sporting activity. Yeah? But it's difficult to call it a sporting activity because there are no, like, rules, and there are no teams, and there are no points. You don't get any points, and nobody wins or loses the game. Yeah, so it's difficult to see it. Another website I went to said that it was a dance, a new kind of dance. But it doesn't really seem that much like a dance to me. Usually in dances, maybe two people dance together, something like this. I've never seen a dance like this before, right? So again, this is a kind of brand new genre, something that is really totally different from anything else, that has totally different conventions, totally different purposes, and totally different sets of expectations. I think that a good way to understand genres is to look at movie genres, partly because all of us are very familiar with movies, and second, because movies can show us something very important about genres, something about the way genres are internested into other genres and combined with other genres. What do you think the genre of this movie is here? Games gamblers play. How do you know it's a comedy? Well, part of the reason you know it's a comedy is because the people who are acting in it. Yeah? So certain actors always act in comedies. So for example, you see a new movie by so-and-so, you know, oh, he's a comedy actor, this is going to be a comedy movie, right? Another way you know this is a comedy is just the way the poster is designed, isn't it, right? With a kind of cartoon figures and stuff like that. So, in a way, this is a comedy, but it also participates in another genre that I think is very kind of unique to Hong Kong movies. And that's the genre of the gambling movie. Right? There are a lot of gambling movies in Hong Kong. Right? King of Gamblers, you know, gambling this, gambling that. So many movies about gambling. Right? And what this movie does, and a lot of the movies about gambling are not comedies, are they? They're very serious movies. Right? So this takes the genre, right, of the gambling movie and turns it into a comedy. So it kind of transforms that genre. It's a little bit like Shaolin Soccer. You know Shaolin Soccer? You know Shaolin Soccer? Great movie. Such a funny movie. Right? Yeah? So it takes a genre of a kung fu movie, right, and turns it into a comedy, transforms it into a comedy. So again, we can see two different genres meeting. You know this movie? Huh? Jackie Chan movie, very famous Jackie Chan movie. What is this? What's the genre? Is it a love story? Love story between these two guys? Huh? Action. It's an action movie. Right? So it's an action movie, a lot of shooting, chasing, things like that. Is it only an action movie? It's also a comedy. Right? It's actually really quite a funny movie. Right? And so at the bottom of the poster, it says, this year's funniest action/comedy. Right? So it's not just an action movie. It's not just a comedy. It's an action comedy. Right? Or maybe a comedy action movie. Right? So I'd like to look at a few more here. I'm sorry, the pictures are not very good. Yeah? This one, anyone know what this one is? You can. This is Hairspray. Very good. Did you see Hairspray? Yeah? You see it, Joe? Really funny, wasn't it? Yeah. So this is Hairspray. This one, Zhonghua Yinxiong. You know this one? It's quite a little bit old, this one. Yeah? Brokeback Mountain. You all know Brokeback Mountain? This one? Can you read this one? This is a Korean movie. It's on right now. Anyone see this movie? You saw this movie? You saw this movie in Korea, did you? Oh, you saw it here? Oh, okay, great. And this one here, what's that? Underdog. Yeah? Underdog movie. So we have one, two, three, four, five movies. Okay? So I'm going to divide you into groups, and I want you, each group is going to talk about one movie. All right? And I want you to tell me, what is the genre? And if you think it's a mixture of genres, you can say it's a mixture of genres. So you can try to draw circles like this to show its relationship with other genres. And then I want you to tell me what are the usual features? What are the usual features of this genre? So, for example, a feature of a comedy is it's funny. You know, a feature of a comedy, it has a happy ending, or at least not a sad ending. Right? And then finally, I want you to tell me, what is the usual storyline? What is the usual storyline of this kind of movie? That is, what usually happens in this kind of movie? And I'm sure that when you think about it, you'll realize that many of these movies that we watch actually have the same story. Right? It's just different characters in a different place. But basically the same thing in general happens throughout the movie. So we're going to have five groups, yeah? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Right? This square of people here. Right? I want you to discuss 中华英雄. Yeah? And then you four, yeah? I want you to discuss the Korean movie, since you have a Korean person who can help you to discuss that movie. You guys here, yeah? I want you to discuss. Has anyone seen this one? Okay, you've seen this one. You haven't seen Rogue Ride Mountain? You discuss this one, okay? Okay. How are we going to divide this? Divide it here or divide it here? What would you like? You like a whole row? This row? Okay. So the back row, I want you to discuss this one. Underdog. Yeah? And then the front row, since Joe has seen it, you can discuss this one. Okay? Three things. Genre, features, storyline. I'll give you about 10, 15 minutes. Okay. Let's start with this group back here, shall we? Okay. 中华英雄, what is it? What is it? What is it? It's okay, so it's an action movie. Definitely an action movie. An action movie or an adventure movie? Yeah? I think there might be a slight difference in an action movie and an adventure movie. An adventure movie usually involves some kind of adventure, right? So some kind of journey to find something, right? An action movie just involves action. So maybe it's an action movie, maybe it's an adventure movie. But it's really quite different from Rush Hour and other kinds of action movies. It has some very distinct features. So is there any subgenre within an action movie that we can call it? Kitty? You agree with what Kitty is saying? Is it a kung fu movie? I don't think we can call it a kung fu movie, but I think that we can call it a martial arts movie. It's a martial arts movie involving some kind of martial arts. Not necessarily kung fu. It's really martial arts using this thing. What's this called? Sword. So you don't have to say the W when you say sword. You don't say sword, right? It's sword, okay? So it's not just a martial arts movie. It's a special kind of martial arts movie, all right? It's what we call a swordsman movie. And I know this is a special genre because if you go to buy comic books in Hong Kong, you can buy one special kind of comic book that are always about these guys with the swords. Right? There are novels also in Hong Kong about these guys with the swords. So it's a particular kind of genre called a swordsman movie, right? About people who fight with swords. Yeah? People who fight with swords. So what are the features of this kind of movie? You guys have any ideas? What are the features? What usually happens in this kind of movie? Okay, so they're always fighting. Yeah? And there are always enemies, right? In fact, there's always the good guys and the bad guys, isn't it? Always the good guys and the bad guys in this kind of movie. Right? And you know who the good guys are, and you really want the good guys to win, and you hate the bad guys. Yeah? Anything else? What is the setting of this new movie usually? Is it like, you know, Mongkok or mountains, countryside? What is the time? What time? I mean, does it like, you know, 1997 or something? 2006? No? What time period are they usually set in?
Ancient times.
Ancient times, right? So some kind of ancient times. So usually old, are they set in Europe or?
No, China.
China, has to be set in China. Are they set in Japan? No, they're not. Because if it were set in Japan, it would be a different kind of movie. It would be a samurai movie. You know, the Japanese swords, the Japanese guys that have swords, they're different. They're called samurais. Right? Different kind of sword, different kind of fighting, different kind of story. Right? So this is a swordsman. It always takes place in old China. What's the story? What's the story of this movie? I don't mean the story of this movie in particular, but what is usually the story of this movie, of this kind of movie? The enemies are defeated, right? So they're defeated by who? Okay. So the hero, right? There's always a hero. And in fact, the name of the movie is Chinese Hero. So there is a hero. There's always a hero in this kind of movie. Is the hero usually a man or a woman? Always a man, never a woman. Right? Is the hero young or old? Old man. Is the hero like an old man? Handsome young guy. Yeah? Usually not an old man. So, but usually there is an old man in this movie. Right? But the old man is like, you know, the counselor. He gives advice. You know, he tells him, oh, this is how you use the sword. Or maybe gives him some kind of special sword to use or something like this. So there's always some old guy somewhere in this movie. Right? But he's not the hero. So the hero, right, starts out with a hero. And usually it involves the hero fighting against the enemy, often to take revenge. Revenge. Yeah. Revenge is a very, very kind of common theme in this kind of movie. R-E-V-E-N-G. Sorry, my handwriting is quite bad. Revenge. Right? So it involves usually some kind of journey. Right? The hero finds out something. Right? So there's some kind of revelation. The hero finds out something, wants to take revenge on somebody, takes a journey, encounters problems. So the hero's trying to go find the enemy to take revenge, and then he has to fight a whole bunch of different kinds of people to get to the enemy, right? Always encounters obstacles, always encounters some kind of problems, and then there's a battle. A fight between the hero and the enemy. Right? And who wins?
Hero.
Hero wins. All the movies are like that. All the movies have exactly the same plot. Right? Every single one has the same structure. Right? And the hero always wins at the end. Right? What about the second one? What about this one, Hairspray? What would you call this one?
Musical comedy.
Okay, that's good. A musical comedy. So, on one hand, it's a musical, but not all musicals are comedies. What are the features of a musical? Dancing and singing. People sing, people dance, right? But it's also a comedy. Is it anything else? Okay, so it's a love story. So it's a musical comedy love story. Anything else? This movie is actually set in the 1960s in America. I grew up in the 1960s in America. And I'm kind of old. At that time, black people and white people didn't go to the same school, right? So I went to the white school, the black people went to the black school. Black people and white people didn't use the same toilet. Yeah? There's a separate toilet for black people, separate toilet for white people. Drinking fountains, right? Black people and white people used separate drinking fountains. So if you see drinking fountain, there's, you know, one very, very nice one for the white people and then one very bad one for the black people, that sort of thing. So during the 1960s, this changed, right? There was a lot of social change, right? And schools and other things became integrated. But it was very, very difficult because a lot of people didn't like this. They really opposed it, right? So the movie is really about some kind of social issue, right, or social problem. It's about discrimination, isn't it? It's about racism, right? So, and there is a special kind of genre for that movie, isn't it? That kind of social problem movie. So, social problems. This movie is actually four different genres put together, isn't it? Four different genres put together. So it's actually a very, very complicated kind of movie and a very interesting movie in that way. Have a lot of people seen this movie? Go and see it. It's really a great movie, really a funny movie. I really enjoyed it. Right? Another thing about this movie, though, it's one other kind of genre of movie. That's what we call a cult movie. You know what cult means? A cult is a small religious group. Yeah? A small religious group, usually kind of extreme. For example, Falun Gong. You know Falun Gong? Okay? They're described as a cult. Now, when I say this is a cult movie, I don't mean it's a religious movie. I mean that certain movies don't become very, very popular, but certain small groups of people really like them. Right? Well, the thing about this movie is this is actually a remake of an earlier movie. Right? Back in the 1960s, they made a movie called Hairspray, but it wasn't a very popular movie, but it was a cult movie. A small group of people really liked this movie. Right? And so this is a cult movie. It's also a remake. R-E-M-A-K-E. Sorry, my handwriting's bad. It's also a remake. Yeah. So a remake is they've made the movie before, right? But then they're going to make it again. Right? For example, there's a movie called The Lovers. Do you know the movie The Lovers? It's with this Taiwanese, Japanese actor, that sort of thing. This is actually a remake of an old Hong Kong movie called Yuan Xianglong and the story about the girl who goes to school, dresses up as a boy to go to school. What's the name of that movie? Liang Shanbo and Julian Dai. Yeah? Liang Shanbo and Julian Dai. Right? So The Lovers is actually a remake of that movie. Right? Let's take a look at this one. This one. You guys saw this one. What is this one? A horror movie. But you know, there are a lot of kinds of horror movies. Some horror movies involve, you know, some alien from outer space coming. Yeah? Some kind of horror movies involve some kind of monster, like Godzilla coming and eating Tokyo. Yeah? Some horror movies involve some kind of crazy guy who's killing everybody, you know, like Friday the 13th and, you know, Jason and Freddy, and they're always killing teenagers. It's always people your age, isn't it? Right? They're, you know, you're at a party with your friends, you know, and then you hear the music, da-dun, 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 you know, and someone's talking to someone, and suddenly they've disappeared, right? This kind of movie? Is it this kind of movie? No. So what kind of horror movie is it? Ghost movie. Very good. It's a ghost movie. So, what usually happens in these kinds of ghost movies or these kinds of horror movies? The ghost is going to take revenge. So, very often they have some kind of component of revenge, right? But they've got to have a ghost, right? And the ghost tries to kill people. And then what happens in the end of these kinds of movies? Does the ghost win? Yes. Sometimes the ghost wins. Sometimes it doesn't. But one thing that's very common in this kind of movie, this kind of horror movie, is what we call an open ending. An open ending means that you think it's finished, but it's not really finished. Like, you think they really killed the alien, but then at the very end of the movie, you can see, you know, like the alien is buried under a building, right? And you think, and you see the alien's hand kind of outside there. And you think the alien is dead and everyone's happy. And they all go, okay, good, the alien's dead, we can leave, you know? And then at the very end of the movie, you can see some slight movement, right? Well, the reason for that is that so they can make the next movie, right? So they can make Alien 2 movies, right? So very often an open ending is a bit. This is an interesting movie, though, isn't it? Because in the end, you're not really sure that the ghost is really, really a ghost, right? You think it actually might be all inside the mind of one of the characters, right? So, along with a ghost movie, it's also what we might call a psychological thriller. Anyone see the movie Sixth Sense? Sixth Sense? All right. So that has a similar kind of thing. And one feature we often find in this kind of movie is what we call a twist. A twist. You know what a twist is? A twist is something happens in the story that's totally unexpected. You think that everything is this way, and then suddenly at the end of the movie, you find it's not like that at all. It's totally different. So, for example, in The Sixth Sense, at the end of the movie, you find out that this guy is actually dead, right? And that's why the kid can talk to him. That's throughout the whole movie, you think, oh, he's just a person, you know, going through his job and stuff. And in the end, you realize that he's actually dead, but he doesn't even know he's dead. That's what we call a twist, yeah? Brokeback Mountain. What's Brokeback Mountain? What's Brokeback Mountain? What kind of movie is it? Kitty? Okay, love story? Love story? Gay movie? Gay movie? What else? Okay, good. Social problem movie? Anything else? One very particular kind of genre, very, very popular in America, called a Western. A Western. A Western is a cowboy movie. Right? So it's a cowboy movie. So again, just like this one here, this is a very, very complicated movie. It's not just one kind of movie, right? In fact, it's also a tragedy, isn't it? Because it has a sad ending, so it's a tragedy as well. So we have basically five different kinds of movies, right? And the kinds of conventions of these different kinds of movies are mixed together, are woven together, and that gives to the movie a kind of twist, a kind of twist. So, for example, a Western always has a very, very clear kind of plot, right? Usually it involves friends. Two or more cowboys who are friends, right? They go out on a journey riding their horses, you know? Go out on the journey, right? They encounter the bad guys. You know the bad guys are bad guys because the bad guys wear black hats and the white guys wear white hats, right? So you know the bad guys are bad guys, right? And then they always defeat defeat the bad guys, right, and they reach their goal at the end. So there's always some kind of goal they reach at the end. They find the gold, or they find the treasure, or they succeed in doing something that they set out to do. So one thing that's interesting is that this movie creates a twist to this, right? So it has the friendship part, but the friendship is a little more than friendship, right? So that creates a twist on it, right? The journey that they go on is really more of a psychological journey, really more of an emotional journey. They do go someplace. They go to Brokeback Mountain, right? So they actually do take a journey, right? But the real journey, right, is the journey of their relationship, right? The journey inside. So it kind of becomes a love story. But it's a love story that doesn't work out very well, so then it becomes a tragedy. So what the movie does is it mixes these genres in a way that kind of shocks you or surprises you or seems a little bit different. So the point I'm trying to make with all of these movies for when we talk about genre is it's not so simple, is it? Right? You can't say, okay, here, this is this genre, and it should be like that. In fact, most of the really good movies, the ones who like win the Oscar and stuff like that, it's really hard to pin down what genre it is, right? Because the movie makers strategically mix parts of different genres to create this kind of effect. Last one is Underdog. Who was doing Underdog? Was it you guys? Underdog? What is Underdog? What's Underdog? It's a comedy. Is it just a comedy? Okay. It's a movie about a hero, but there's a special kind of movie about a hero that this is. It's what we call a superhero movie. Superhero movie, right? So superhero movie always involves a hero, and he always wears a funny costume, and he always has some kind of powers. So, for example, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, right? All these are hero movies. Right, and in this movie, right, the superhero is a dog. Right. What else is it? Who is the main hero in this? Who is the main actor in this movie? A dog. So it's an animal movie. You know, there are all these animal movies, like the talking pig. You know, the one with the talking pig. And the penguins, there was that movie about the penguins, right? Very popular animal movies. People like to go see animal movies, isn't it? Right? So what this director did is he strategically put together all three of these different genres to create a kind of a new genre, a kind of a special movie. And this is also a remake. It's a remake because there used to be a cartoon on TV called Underdog. I know because I watched this cartoon when I was a kid. It's a very old cartoon, the ancient cartoon, right? And it was about, you know, it was about this guy. So they took a cartoon. This is a very interesting genre they have nowadays, is they take a cartoon and they make it into like a real movie with real people, right? So, for example, the Flintstones. Did you see the Flintstones? Yeah, the Flintstones. The Flintstones is a cartoon, but they actually made it into a real movie with real people. So that in itself is kind of a special genre. So as I say, the point of all this is to show you how actually very complicated genres are. And not only that, that they're not complicated in just a random way, that people don't just mix these genres together just for nothing, that they mix these genres together to make good movies, to make a lot of money from these movies. They mix them together in this kind of strategic way, this kind of skillful way that plays on your expectations. Like you go and think, oh, this is going to be a Western. Oh, I'm going to watch a Western now. And then you see the guys kissing. And so you have a set of expectations. That's really all that genre is a set of expectations, right? And it changes those expectations or works with those expectations in order to surprise you. So you think, oh, I'm going to go see a comedy, right? And then the comedy, you know, a lot of people get killed and stuff. And you think, oh, it's not what I expected. It's not really a comedy. It's more of an action movie, right? So this is all very, very intentional and very skillful and very strategic. So let's take a short break now. Let's take a 15-minute break, yeah? And we'll come back and we'll talk a bit more about genre. So lots of different kinds of people study genres, and studying genres is part of lots of different fields of study. For example, people who study literature, people who do literary studies, study different kinds of genres and what makes a particular kind of genre, what are the features of various genres. People who study film studies, quite similar to what we were doing last hour, they also study genre. People who study something called stylistics, which is analyzing the different kinds of writing styles of different kinds of texts, they also study genres. But what we're going to be focusing on today is a particular kind of discourse analysis called genre analysis, which focuses on genre. But it focuses on genre in a slightly different way than all of those other kinds of fields of study. So what is a genre? Well, this is from the first paragraph of your reading for this week. This is from Vijay Bhatia. And he says that... And he says that a genre is an idea that was developed by a guy named John Swales. I'm sure that Steve Bremner has already told you something about John Swales. And so he says that a genre is a recognizable communicative event. Recognizable in that as soon as you see it, Henry, you recognize it. You say, oh, that's a comedy. Oh, that's a Western. Oh, that's a swordsman movie, right? So it's recognizable to a particular group of people. But if, you know, an alien came here from outer space and you took him to the movies and he's never seen a comedy before, he wouldn't recognize it as a comedy. So it's recognizable to a particular group of people who have learned about this genre and who have learned what makes this genre and how this genre is put together. It's characterized by a set of communicative purposes. So genres always have a purpose, yeah? What's the purpose of a comedy? To make you laugh, yeah? What's the purpose of a tragedy? To make you cry, okay? So genres always have some kind of purpose, right? And this purpose is, Vijay says, mutually understood by members of professional or academic community in which it regularly occurs. And so another very important concept about genre is that it occurs within a particular group of people, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be a professional or academic community. For example, we're looking at movie genres, right? We are the community of moviegoers, yeah, who understand what these genres are. Most often it is highly structured and conventionalized with constraints on allowable contributions in terms of their intent, positioning, form, and functional value. So what this means is that they're always put together in the same way. They always have the same features. There are certain things that are allowable in a genre and certain things that are not allowable in a genre. So if you have a comedy and everybody dies, it's not a comedy because everybody dying is not allowable in a comedy. It's not permitted in a comedy. These constraints, and I think this is the most important point that he makes, these constraints, however, are often exploited by expert members of the discourse community to achieve private intentions within the framework of socially recognized purposes. What this means is that even though a genre has certain conventions, even though a genre has certain rules that you're supposed to follow, if you are an expert user of that genre, you can change the rules a little bit, right? You can alter the rules a little bit for some kind of strategic purpose, right? If you are an expert member. So Ang Lee makes this movie Brokeback Mountain, right? It's a Western, right? People watch this and say, wait a minute, this is not a Western. The cowboys are kissing. They're not supposed to be kissing. Right? Ali can say, wait a minute, I'm an expert user of this genre. Right? I'm an expert movie director, and because I'm an expert, I'm able to figure out a way to change the rules a little bit. So the rules of a genre are not necessarily firm and set. Right? In fact, genres, the best genres, are the ones that expert users can change a little bit, right? Can strategically organize in order to create some kind of special effect or make you pay attention in some particular kind of way. So what is genre analysis? Well, genre analysis is an approach that attempts to explain regularities in text in terms of the shared communicative purposes within discourse communities. So as Bowie mentioned in the beginning of the class, we're always getting back to this idea of purpose and community. That genres always have a particular purpose within a particular kind of community. One of the ways that we analyze the regularities in particular kinds of texts or movies or TV shows or songs is by looking at what is called the move structure of the text. The move structure of the text. And I know that Steve has already taught you quite a lot about move structure, yes? So if you hear anything else about move structure, you're going to die, right? You don't want to hear any. Well, let me just talk a little bit about move structure. But first I want to talk a little bit about John Swales and his idea about genre. One of the important things that John Swales said was that genres are always historically and socially situated within a particular time, within a particular place, within a particular community. So you have this genre called the Western, right? But really, a Western is an American genre. Right? It's about American cowboys. Right? You don't have Westerns in other countries. Right? So it's historically situated within a particular place, which is America, and even within a particular time. Right? Westerns actually are not very popular anymore. They were much more popular in the 1940s, 1950s, that sort of thing. Right? Cowboy movies, not so popular anymore. Right? What genre analysis does, it attempts to explain the regularities in text in terms of the shared communicative purposes within these social communities. And so, again, we get back to the whole idea of action. Yeah? That discourse is used to take certain action. That discourse always has some kind of social purpose. And the only way you can really understand discourse, the only way you can really analyze discourse, is by taking into account the actions that it's used to take, taking into account its community purposes. And so genre really consists of three things. First, it consists of the thing itself, right? The communicative event, the movie or the letter or the book or whatever it is. But it also includes the various communicative purposes that people use this particular event or this particular text for. And finally, it includes the discourse community of the people who use this text. Now, a discourse community, we actually have talked about communities before. We talked about communities of practice. Right? Communities of practice are defined by the social practices that people do. So a community of practice is a group of people who do something together. A discourse community is quite similar, but slightly different. A discourse community is a group of people who use the same genres, basically. And so a discourse community is basically defined by the genres that they use. And they use these genres in order to fulfill some kind of communicative purpose, in order to do something. And so they have some kind of shared goal, some kind of shared purpose. They come together with a shared goal and they use these genres. Another very important thing about a discourse community is that there is usually communication between the members of a discourse community, right? So I think that we can call our group of people here a discourse community, right? But we couldn't call all students in the world a discourse community because there's no communication between all students in the world. But there is communication among you. So each discourse community owns a particular set of genres. And in fact, if you want to be a member of this discourse community, you need to master the genre. That's the whole point of the discourse community. People who have been able to master the genre, who know how to produce the genre or interpret the genre, they can be members of the discourse community. But those who can't be members of the discourse community. So a good example is university students. University students must master the genre of the public examination. You have to know how to do it. You have to know how to take an examination. You have to know how to pass an examination. That's the only way you can become a university student. If you can't do it, then you can't become a university student. Or someone like me. I'm an academic, a professor. And in order for me to be an academic and professor, I have to master the genre of writing an academic article. If I can't write an academic article, I lose my job, isn't it? So I need to master this genre. If you want to be a crumper, remember the crumpers from last week? Okay, you need to master the genre of crumping. You can't just go along and stand there, right? You can't be a member of the community. They won't let you in. So the whole idea is that membership in the community depends on what we might call literacy in the genre. That is, the ability to either produce or interpret the genre skillfully. So membership, the way people become members of discourse community, is by learning how to do the various genres. I want you to take a few minutes and just think of one or two discourse communities that you belong to and just jot them down. Write down the community and then write down what is the goal of this community, what is the purpose of this community, and what kinds of genres do you have in this community? What kind of genres do you need to master in order to become a member of this community? Just take one or two minutes to jot that down. Okay, let's hear what you came up with. Sally, give me an example of a discourse community you belong to. Okay, you belong to the drama club. That's wonderful, right? What is the purpose of being a member of the drama club? To have fun. Yeah, to have fun. Maybe to learn something about drama. Learn how to act or something like that, and have fun. Okay, so what kind of genres do you have to master to be a member of the drama society? You need to master the drama, don't you? Yeah? The drama is the genre that you need to master. In fact, the name of the society comes from the genre, isn't it? Right? So you have to master the genre of the drama in various ways. Right? Maybe you're an actor in the society and you need to master the part of the drama that involves acting, saying the lines, and that sort of thing. Also, you may not be an actor. You may be in charge of scenery, something like that, right? You know, making the scenery or the lighting, right? And you have to master that aspect of the drama. And so drama is a very, very... Are there any other genres you need to master to be a member of the drama society? Any other genres you have to master to be a member of the drama society? How do members of the drama society communicate with each other? How do you know when there's a meeting of the drama society? You receive an email? Okay. So email or a phone call? Okay. Email, telephone. These are genres that you have to master to be a member. If you can't use a telephone, if you can't use email, you can't be a member of the drama society, right? So even small genres like this are absolutely essential, right? But each genre has a different communicative purpose, right? So the acting, the drama part of the drama society has one purpose. The email has another purpose, the purpose of alerting members to a new meeting, that sort of thing. Okay, let's take another. Janice, give me an example of a genre that you, a discourse community that you belong to. BA, English for the Professions. It's a wonderful discourse community, right? So what are the features of this particular discourse community other than the fact that it contains the best students in City University? What are some of the genres that you have to use? Okay, you have to take examinations. That's one genre. Anything else? Okay, so be careful not to confuse a genre with a skill. Okay, a genre is the text, right? So you need to be able to produce an examination script. You need to be able to produce various assignments. Yeah? Anything else? What are we doing here? We're having a lesson. Yeah? So a lesson is another genre that you have to master, right? Blackboard is a kind of a genre that you have to master, right? Email is a kind of a genre that you have to master. So that's good. Anyone write down like a church group or anything like that? Church group? No? Joanne, what about you? What's a discourse community you belong to? MSN users. Are MSN users a discourse community? What do you think? Well, you can say that they share a common genre in that they all use MSN. Yes? But do they communicate with one another? You communicate with all the MSN users in the world? So I'm not so sure MSN users is a discourse community because there's not intercommunication between members. Right? But maybe I think that your list, yeah, on your MSN, you have a list of all your friends. That's a discourse community, right? Because you have communication with all of those people. And many of those people also have communication with each other, right? So that group you might call a discourse community. And in that case, the genres that they have to master, so many different genres in MSN. It's not just MSN, is it? Right? So one of the genres in MSN is the screen name. You know the screen name? That's the name you have in MSN, right? So you need to be able to come up with a good screen name, right? If you come up with a stupid screen name, then people will laugh at you. Oh, what, Bowie, you have a stupid screen name? What is your screen name? Yeah, you see, that's not a very good screen name, right? You have to think of a really, really good screen name. And there's this also on MSN, you can write the screen name and then you can write some caption or message or something like that. That's also a genre. So you can write, you know, your screen name is Bowie, and then you can write, I love discourse and pragmatics. Yeah. So the screen name tells who you are, and then that line tells something about you or something that you're doing or something like that. So in order to be an MSN user, you've got to master the genre of the screen name and the message that you put next to the screen name. You've got to know how to do it, right? Good. One more. How about Terry? Terry, you're the discourse community you belong to. Okay, that's a very good one. That's very good. So you belong to a group of people that play basketball. Okay, so you play basketball every week. Maybe, yeah, at least every week, right? Maybe twice, three times a week. Okay. What genre do you have to master to be a member of your basketball group? Okay, good. You have to be able to SMS? Sometimes, okay. Anything else? Suppose I want to join your basketball group. I say, hey, you know, I love basketball. Let me play basketball with you, right? And, you know, I get on the basketball court and I start. Would you let me be a member of your basketball team? No. Of course not, right? Because I'm playing soccer. I'm playing football, not basketball, right? So, of course, the most important genre is basketball, right? You've got to know how to play basketball. You've got to know the rules of basketball, right? You've got to know how many points you get when you have a basket. You've got to know how you know, what are the rules that allow somebody to take a shot, a free shot, things like this. And so the rules are very important for basketball. Do you ever talk to each other when you're playing basketball? What do you say? Galjo. Yeah. So one genre is the genre of encouraging or congratulating your teammates, But I think another genre in a lot of basketball groups, and I'm not sure it's the same with your group, but a lot of basketball groups, an important genre is the insult. Yeah? That the guys play basketball and they insult each other all the time. It's like, ah, target. You know, if you listen to these guys, right? They're always using foul language, calling each other names, things like that, right? I'm not saying in your basketball group, but quite a lot of basketball groups, male basketball groups, the insult is an important genre to master if you really want to be a member of this group. So we have shared communicative purposes, right? We have being able to master the genre to be a member of the discourse community. Now we want to look at how we actually analyze the genre, how we actually take the text and decide how to analyze it. And in genre analysis, we analyze text in terms of moves. Right? The idea of moves is just like in a chess game. You know, I make a move, you make a move, things like that. Right? So a move is something that you do. And that's the best way to think of a move. Something that you do. So when you're trying to analyze a genre and you're looking at a section of the text, the question you need to ask yourself is, what are they doing? Yeah? What is the purpose that they are fulfilling in this particular section of the text? John Swales came up with this idea of moves by analyzing the introductions to academic articles. So he got academic articles from every field, from biology and chemistry and linguistics and communications and history and Chinese literature and everything. And he found that actually, even though all these fields are quite different, all of the introductions to the academic articles followed the same pattern. Yeah? That in all of the introductions, the author had to fulfill four purposes. The author had to do four things. First, the author establishes the field in which the writer of the study is working. So, begins the article by saying, genre analysis is a very important form of discourse analysis that is used for many years, something like this. So now you know what it's about. He's going to be talking about genre analysis. Second thing, summarize the related research or interpretations of one aspect of the field. One important aspect of the field of genre analysis is the idea of discourse community. Several people have researched this idea, and so-and-so said this, and the other person said that, and somebody else said this. So you just kind of give an idea of what other people have said. Third, create some kind of space for your own idea. Right? So even though people have analyzed, you know, many different kinds of discourse communities, not many people have analyzed MSN as MSN users in Hong Kong as a kind of a discourse community. Right? So you say, I'm going to analyze something new. And then fourth, introduce the study by indicating what the investigation will accomplish in the field. So in my study, I'm going to investigate MSN users in Hong Kong and the way they form a discourse community by using various tools in MSN. Okay? So all academic introductions are like that. In fact, when you write an academic paper, you're not writing any academic paper for this course, but the other courses you're taking, you might write an academic paper, you should pay attention to that. That's what you got to do in the first paragraph. Those four things need to be accomplished in the first paragraph for the reader to think, oh yeah, I understand what's going on. I understand that this is, you know, this is what's going on. People who read academic articles, like me and you, expect that. Right? So you know that when you're reading your academic article for your critique for this course, you know when you look in the first paragraph, these four kinds of information are going to be included. Right? At least in the first one or two paragraphs, these four things are going to be there. And this actually helps you to read the academic article. So you have this kind of set of expectations, this kind of schema in your head, so that when you go to the academic article, it's easy to read because you know what's going to come first, what's going to come next, what's going to come after that. You already know what's going to happen. So here we have a different kind of genre. Good-looking professional male, 44, into most sports, theater, eating out, and flying, wishes to meet sincere, caring, mature lady, 30 to 50, for friendship, possible romance. Huh? Interested, Bowie? Sorry, you're too young, 30 to 50. Yeah? Gorgeous Gemini seeks sexy Sagittarian. Any Sagittarians? Yeah? For fun nights out, no expense spared. For £2, who could resist? Hope I'm still 26 before you answer. Photo appreciated. Gorgeous, immodest or deluded, single professional female, 22, seeks single professional handsome hunk to restore my faith in human nature. German? Photograph preferred, but not essential. Okay? It's good, you don't even have to send your photograph. Yeah, it's great. Right? Slim 34-year-old female, 5 feet 8 inches tall, reasonably nice looking, seeks
reasonably
nice looking seeks tall, handsome gent who likes eating out and socializing, must have good sense of humor and like children. Maybe she already has children. We don't know. Right? So this is a particular kind of genre. What is this genre? What would you call this genre? Anyone know? Well, it's a kind of advertisement, isn't it? It's a kind of advertisement, just like an advertisement for a television set or for a soft drink or anything like that. But the product in this advertisement is the person. Right? So we have a special name for this kind of advertisement. Does anyone know what we call this kind of advertisement? It's called a personal advertisement. Personal ad. Or it might be called a dating ad. A dating ad. Right? So the purpose, the communicative purpose of putting this kind of advertisement in the newspaper is what? What's the purpose? Sally? What's the purpose? Why do people put these ads in the newspaper? That's right. They're seeking for a partner. They're trying to find a friend, a lover, or a husband or wife. Yeah, friend, lover, or spouse. Right? People don't use these kinds of advertisements to sell stuff, like selling a computer. If you wanted to sell a computer, Henry, you wouldn't put, good-looking, slim university student, seeks good computer user to buy my computer, right? You wouldn't do it. It just wouldn't make sense, would it? Right? And so the very specific kind of purpose is to find a partner. Not only does this genre have a particular kind of communicative purpose, but it also has very specific, clear, communicative moves. Right? That is, in almost all of these texts, you can see a kind of pattern. First they do one thing, then they do another thing, and then they do another thing, usually in a kind of set, conventionalized order. So what is the first thing that you need to do? What is the first thing that you need to do? Good-looking professional, gorgeous Gemini, gorgeous single professional, slim 34 year. What is the first thing you need to do? Good. Describe yourself. Introduce yourself. Describe yourself. So the first move is describe yourself. And in your self-description, there are going to be certain kinds of constraints, right? That is, when you describe yourself, you usually describe certain things about yourself, such as your appearance. So you might use words like gorgeous, handsome, sexy, things like this, right? Another very important thing you usually put down is your age, right? So you got to tell how old you are, because if people don't know how old you are, maybe a 17-year-old is going to, send their photo to a 50-year-old, something like that. So age tends to be very important. In fact, if we look at these, age is not in all of them, but in many of them, 34, 22, right? So first thing is describe self. Second thing you've got to do. What's the second thing you do? Second thing you do. Okay. Describe target. You describe the kind of person you're looking for. First you describe yourself. Then you describe the kind of person you're looking for. Right? And then the third thing you've got to do is what? So you've described who you are, you describe what you want, who you want, and then you describe what you want them to do. Yeah, or what you want to do with them. Right? What you want them for. Yeah? So for friendship, possible romance. Yeah? Friendship may be more. Right? That kind of thing. Okay? So you describe the purpose. Right? Describe purpose. So you want to have a love relationship, you want to have quick sex, you want to have a marriage, you want to have a friendship, you want to have romantic evenings at home, you know, you want to have fun, adventurous trips to Europe, right? Those are the kinds of things you put in this section. So you can see all of these ads have these three moves. They've got to have these three moves. If they don't have these three moves, they're not this kind of ad, are they? Right? They don't work as this kind of ad, because this kind of information, as a reader of this kind of ad, these three pieces of information are the essential pieces of information you need to know in order to decide whether or not you're going to reply to the ad. There are other moves as well, you know, more optional moves. For example, photo. You can tell whether you want a photo or whether you don't want a photo. So, for example, here it says, photo, please. And here it says, photograph preferred but not essential. Right? And so, as a reader of these ads, you're looking for these three things, and maybe this fourth thing as well. And you're also generally looking for it in the same order. Yeah? That usually the description of the person who wrote the ad is in the beginning of the ad. And in this case, right, it's capitalized. Right? So it makes it very efficient. You know, you're very busy studying BAEP, but you also want to find a good partner. So you go to the newspaper, you open this up, and you don't want to have to read through all the ads, right? So you can just look at the first line. Oh, good-looking professional. Not interested in professionals. Oh, gorgeous Gemini. Hate Geminis. Oh, gorgeous single professional female. No, I don't want it. Slim 30. Oh, yeah. I like a slim woman here. This is the one I want, right? So you don't have to read through all the ads. You just read through the beginning, and you know what kind of person they are. And if you're interested in that person, then you can go on to find out what they want. Right? And if they want the kind of person you are, then you can go on to find out what they want you for. Yeah? So, in a way, these ads are written in a very kind of efficient way, isn't it? A way that allows you to go through them very quickly, find out what you want. A way that allows the user to use them in a very efficient way. But then we have this. Life begins at 40. Are you fit? Life begins at 40. Are you fit? Is that a description of the self? No. Is it a description of the target? A little bit. It's asking the target a question, but not exactly. Is it a description of the purpose? Well, you don't know what they mean. Are you fit? Are we going to go to the gym together or what? What are you talking about, right? It's a little strange. It's a little weird. But does that mean that this is a bad example of the genre? Does that mean that this person is not a good member of this community of personal ad users because she did her genre wrong? She put it in the wrong order. She put something first that doesn't belong there. Well, in a way we can say it is wrong. But on the other hand, we can say it's actually quite clever, isn't it? Right? Because if you're reading this ad, this one sticks out. Life begins at 40. It's like totally unexpected. Why would you put that there? It surprises you. It surprises you so that you want to read the ad. And you find out glamorous granny seeks granddad to go out and show them how to live or stay in and babysit and find romance. So it has all of these features in it. It has a description of the self. It has a description of a target. It has a description of a purpose. But it doesn't start out the way most of them others do. Right? It starts out in a slightly different way. And that doesn't necessarily make it bad. In fact, I think in this case, it actually makes it good. Right? It makes this ad a little bit unique. Right? And it makes people notice it. Because if you read 100 of these ads every day, and then, oh, you see something a little different, you notice it. So this is an example of an expert user, and I think this is an expert user of personal ads, of an expert user breaking the rules a little bit in order to achieve some kind of special purpose. So a real important point about genre is that genre is always strategic. If you are an expert user of a genre, you don't have to follow all the rules. You don't have to do it exactly the way everyone else has always done it. You can change it. You can make the cowboys kiss. Yeah? You can say something like, life begins at 40, when you're supposed to say something else. But not everyone can do that, right? If you're not an expert user of the genre, you don't know how to do that. Right? You don't know how to do it well, at least. And so for people like you guys, you're learning how to write various business genres, right? And so when you write like a sales letter or a complaint letter or these kinds of letters, you look in the book about business letters, right? You see the model answer, right? And you basically copy the model answer, right? That's okay. That's the way you learn how to write a genre. You copy the model answer. But then when you become, you know, the executive manager for some company, right? And you have to produce these texts, you don't have to go to the textbook and copy the model, do you? In fact, if you do, if you copy the model, then you're not going to be successful, isn't it? Because people will get your letter and say, oh, this is just like the model, so boring. Right? So you know when you're an expert how to change the genre slightly. You know where you can change the genre and where you can't change the genre. So that's a very, very important key point about genres. So let's just go through what Bhatia said about genres. A genre is a communicative event, a clear communicative event. The important thing about a communicative event is that you can tell where it begins and where it ends. Right? So these personal ads, you can tell where each one begins and where each one ends. In fact, they're separated by lines, aren't they? It has a set of clear communicative purposes. Right? The purpose is to find a partner, to find a friend, to find a lover, to find a husband. These purposes are shared by a discourse community. The discourse community is the community of people who write and read these kinds of ads. And not everybody does. How many people here have written this kind of advertisement put in the newspaper? Even if you did, you wouldn't say. You wouldn't raise your hand, right? But most people are not a member of this discourse community. This is really a special discourse community, isn't it? Right? A special group of people who try to find partners in this way. We can see that the advertisements are highly structured and highly conventionalized, that they all contain three moves, at least, and these three moves tend to be in a particular order, tend to be in the same order. Right? And that within this structure, there are certain constraints on allowable contributions, right? For example, you couldn't write something like the definition of genre analysis in this kind of ad. No one would understand it. It simply is not allowable, right? So these constraints have to do with the intent, right? The only intent you can have in this kind of advertisement is to find a partner. You can't use this advertisement to sell your television set. Positioning, so the information tends to be positioned in a clear way with the description of the self coming first, the description of the target coming second, and the description of what you want to do coming third. The form is always the same, and the function, and even the function of different parts of it are always the same, right? The function to attract somebody else, right? To interest somebody else, to get somebody to send their photograph or to reply to your ad. But we've also seen that expert members can break the rules. They can exploit the genre and create something slightly different for their own particular strategic purposes. So I'm going to write my ad, but I'm not going to follow the genre. I'm going to write something slightly different, and that way maybe people will notice me a little more. a lot of the ideas of genre analysis actually come from earlier work done by a linguist named Labov, William Labov, who analyzed stories. And he said, a story is a kind of genre. When, you know, you're sitting together in Pacific Coffee with your friends and you're telling your story, say, oh, something interesting happened to me today, right? You're using a kind of genre, a conversational story. And he said that conversational stories always tend to have the same structure as well. They tend to begin with an abstract. So when you write an academic paper, you write an abstract as well, but it's not exactly that kind of abstract. The abstract is, something interesting happened to me today. Okay? That's the abstract. And that sort of tells you I'm going to tell a story. And then it goes on to the orientation. Right? So the orientation tells you when and where it happened. So I was walking to school today and I saw Bowie. Yeah? So I was walking to school today. So walking to school and today are the orientation, the setting of the story. Then there's got to be some kind of complication, okay? So if I just say, something interesting me happened today. I was walking to school and I saw Bowie. That's the end of the story. It's not a story, is it? Because nothing happened, right? It's not interesting. I told you something interesting happened, but just seeing Bowie at school is not interesting because Bowie's always at school. Every day I go to school, I see Bowie. Right? So I need some kind of complication, right? And so the complication is the real meat of the story. It's really what happened. So I saw Bowie and she was crying. Right? And I asked her, oh, what's wrong? And she said, oh, I feel so sad. I broke up with my boyfriend. I want to jump out of a window, blah, blah, blah. I hope you really didn't break up with your boyfriend, right? So that's the complication, right? And then finally, there's some kind of evaluation and result, right? So the evaluation is, oh, she looked very sad. I'm really worried about Bowie, right? I told her, don't worry, she'll find a new boyfriend. I hope everything will be okay with her. And that's the end of the story. So all stories, you know, whether you're telling them to your friends or even when you're seeing them in the movie, they all follow this same kind of very basic structure. And then very often at the end of the story there's something called a coda, which is a little thing just to end the story. And that's what happened to me today. Something like that. Okay? And that's what happened to Bowie today. Something like that. Right? So just a little sentence at the end to show, okay, that's the end of the story, is called a coda. I did some research on drug addicts in Hong Kong. And drug addicts, they go to a kind of rehabilitation center, yeah? And when you go to the rehabilitation center for drug addicts, you get into these meetings with all the other drug addicts. It's kind of a group therapy thing, right? And each person has to stand up and tell their story, right? And this is called a recovery story. And in order to be a member of the group of recovering drug addicts, you got to learn how to tell the story. In fact, part of the process of recovering from drug addiction or alcoholism or shopping addiction or any other kind of addiction you might have is learning how to tell this kind of story, which is called a recovery story. And one thing I noticed in my data from listening to them tell the stories is all the stories were the same. Right? That is, they had a particular conventionalized move structure. They had a predictable format. And the people who told the stories had to include these things in their format. So first is the introduction. The introduction is usually, oh, my name is Harry Wong, and you know, I used to be a drug addict, and you know, this is me. So an introduction of the self, right? And then an introduction also to their drug use. I started to take drugs when I was in secondary school. I got involved with triad members, and I took drugs in the playground, and, you know, I had a lot of fun and stuff like that. Then comes the complication. But then, you know, my family threw me out, and my girlfriend broke up with me, and I lost all my money, and, you know, life got really bad, right? And then there's a bottom. Right? So the bottom is, things get so bad for them right? That they have no choice but to. And then, you know, one day I was taking drugs in the playground and the police came and they arrested me. I had to go to jail, right? So that's the bottom, right? All the bad things that happened, that's the worst thing that happened, right? The bottom is the turning point, right? The bottom is the part of the story where they realize that they can't be drug addicts anymore. And so sometimes there's a failed reform. Not all the stories have this, but sometimes they say, but you know, then after I got out of jail, I tried to quit drugs and I tried to get a job and stuff like that, but then I got involved with my old friends and they gave me drugs and I started over again. And then the complication in the story can start over again with a new bottom, right? And then after the bottom, there's a transformation. And then I found Jesus Christ, right? And I let Jesus Christ into my life, right? And then, you know, then Jesus helped me to stop taking drugs, and then I became a much better person. Sometimes there's a relapse, right? Even though I found Jesus Christ, I forgot about him, and I started to take drugs again, right? But then I found him again, okay? And then finally, evaluation. And so now I'm very happy, I'm a Christian, I'm a good person, and I don't think I'm going to take drugs again. I think I'm going to have a good life now, right? All of the stories have these kind of basic features to them. And then the coda, and you know, that's the end of the story, and you know, I'm never going to take drugs again, and something like that. Right? So all these stories have the same features. Right? Everybody who tells this story has the same story, basically. Very stable structure. Certain kinds of set phrases. Set phrases like, one day at a time. I'm going to tackle my problem one day at a time. Things like that. So certain kinds of set phrases tend to be in these kinds of stories. Right? They tend to have the same kinds of themes. Themes of helplessness, control, hope, fear, and strength. They always have a bottom. Right? They always have one part of the story where it's the absolute worst thing that could happen to them. You know? And then, you know, I killed my girlfriend or something like that. You know, something really terrible that happens to them that represents the turning point to their story. And almost always these stories have a higher power in them. That is, what I mean by a higher power is some kind of person or God or something higher than them who helped them in their transformation. Right? So they say, oh, then I met Jesus Christ and Jesus helped me to solve my problem. Or they can say, and then I met this social worker and she was really good and she helped me to solve my problem. Or then I fell in love with Bowie and Bowie helped me to solve my problem. Right? So, but there's always some kind of agent of change, some kind of higher power that helps them to solve their problem. So I'm just going to end with this slide. Yeah? Just to kind of remind you of the things that I've been focusing on today in terms of genre analysis. And as I said, I know you're doing quite a lot of genre analysis with Steve, but Steve may not focus so much on these things because he's focusing on genres in professional communication and they tend to be a bit more stable. But one of the main things I'm trying to impress on you today is what we call the tactical aspects of genres. Right? Tactical means strategic. Right? That sure, genres are conventionalized. Sure, they always have basically the same move structure, right? But really good users of genres don't always do it exactly the same way. Really good users of genre use genres in strategic ways, in tactical ways, right? Second thing is that genres are not always the same, right? That genres change, right? They're dynamic, right? So, for example, business letters 50 years ago are written very, very differently than business letters today, right? And then you even have new genres, like Facebook pages and blogs and things like this. So genres are always changing. You can't expect a genre always to be stable. Third point, genres define, organize, and structure social reality, right? So we interact with the members of our group based on the conventions of this genre, right? So the genre structures our social organization. When Terry gets together to play basketball with his friends, as soon as they get onto the basketball field, the group of people divides into two groups of people. Right? So it is the genre of basketball that organizes their social interaction. Right? Without that genre, they would interact in a kind of a different way. Fourth, genre is a kind of social action. We always use genre to do something, right? To fulfill some kind of communicative purposes. Okay? So genre is not a thing. Genre is a verb. Yeah? Genre is an action, a process. And finally, genres signal membership. If you want to be a member of a particular group of people, then you show you're a member of this group of people by mastering the genre. If you're a member of a church group, right, you master the genre of a hymn, right? So you can get up and you can sing the hymn, you can read the words in the hymn, you know which verse to sing first, which verse to sing second. By doing that, you show you're a Christian, yeah? You show you're a member of this group, right? If you can't do that, then people will look at you and say, oh, must be a new member, yeah? And then after the church service, they'll come up to you and say, oh, I haven't seen you before. I notice you don't know how to sing a hymn, right? Let me help you, right? And so another aspect of this membership is that old members teach new members how to use the genre, right? That's the whole purpose, right? So new members of Terry's basketball club, right, they come and they teach them how to play basketball in their way, right? They teach them how to insult each other in their way, right? They teach them how to, whatever they do, the old members teach the new members how to do it. Okay. There are a few more slides here, and I'm going to go over those slides next week. But I also have a little text that I'd like you to look at home so we can discuss it next week as well. And that's this job application letter. It's a very, very simple genre. So I want you to go through this letter, and I want you to look at each paragraph, yeah, and describe what the person is doing in each of the paragraphs. Right? What communicative purpose does each of the paragraphs contain? And then along with this, there's also this little job application here. I just included this job application because it's quite funny, just to make you laugh, okay? So you can read this and laugh. The communicative purpose for this is not so much to teach, but just to give you a little relief from Discourse and Pragmatics, make you laugh a little bit, okay? Are there any questions? Are there any comments? Okay, I'll see you all next week. Have a nice weekend.